First of all, thanks for this opportunity
to learn a bit with you. And I was told that you are the intellectual geniuses of Atlanta, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's think about a subject that I have a special interest in and see if we can think it through together. And at least you will learn to speak English with the correct accent. I happen, my personal background happens to be in medicine, right? I did not grow up from, I grew up normal. And I had a very traditional background, but as it happens, I spent time in medicine. And I've taken a special interest in the halakhas of medical situations, medical dilemmas. And it's a fascinating area of Torah that many Torah don't have much contact with. Let me share with you an insight and analysis into one of the most difficult areas that ever comes up in medicine. And that is where you need to sacrifice one life to save another. Right? What I'm thinking of, the example I'm thinking of, is when you have Siamese twins. Do you know what that is? Children who are joined, right? Fused, born fused with each other. Sometimes you have an unusual situation where if you do nothing, they're both going to die. And you have maybe a possibility of saving one, but the only way you can do that is you have to kill the other one. Right? That's a very, very difficult question. And what I'd like to do, if you, with your permission, is look at a case that occurred in the Jewish world a few years ago, that Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal was asked to make a decision about, and he said it was the most difficult life and death decision he was ever required to make. So let's try and look at how he approached that situation and see if we can think it through together and work it out. And I'm going to give you some questions as we go through. And I think Rabbi Nirenberg has said that he's buy you a whiskey if you get the questions right. So I think that's what he said. So here's the situation. First of all, the background is, you know that Siamese twins are children who fused. You know that sometimes children are born as twins. And there must be some twins here. No? Somebody? Twin? Yeah? Identical twins? Do you have an identical twin?
No.
No. Okay. So, you get two kinds of twinning, right? But one form is where the children are identical, genetically exactly the same. But for and the reason is that when the child is conceived and begins to grow, for some unknown reason, the very, very early developing child within the mother can split into two identical halves. But sometimes, for unknown reasons, the split does not take place fully, and the children remain connected at some or other part of their bodies. For example, there are two girls in this country who are joined by the tops of their heads. Right? They're about 45 years old. Their brains are fused, and their skulls are fused. And they walk around and spend their whole lives joined by the top. They sleep in two beds, head to head. They shower together. They date together. Okay? And as it happens, they are very well adjusted. The one is a country and western singer, and the other one's a nurse. And they somehow manage. Okay? But it isn't always like that. There are two Russian women who are joined from the waist down. In other words, from their hips down, they're one woman, and from the waist up, they are two. Okay? In fact, they do not get on well. The one has become an alcoholic, and her sister has liver damage. Because they share one common circulation, when she drinks, her sister gets drunk. Okay? And she now has damage to her liver, because they are partly one body. This raises, in fact, they don't get on well at all. They hit each other, and they have a lot of tension. But there, all of these situations raise amazing questions. For example, can you see the problem with marrying a woman like that? What would happen if a man married one of those girls? First question is, would he be guilty? Would he be over on marrying two sisters? Don't forget that half of that woman are two people. You see the problem? And there are many other problems. But and these cases have been debated and they've come to court in the non-Jewish world and in the halakhic annals. Also, some of these cases have been there are all sorts of permutations. There was a woman by the name of Rosalie in 1910 who gave birth to a child while joined to her own sister by the back. They were fused back to back. She got married with her sister attached, okay, and she had a child. And you have all sorts of permutations. The reason they called Siamese twins is because there were two boys discovered in Siam in the early 1800s who were joined by their chests when they were little boys. I mean, they were born like that, of course, but when they were found, they were little boys. They were brought to England, and they were exhibited for many years in a circus. When they were slightly older, they came to America. They became farmers. They both married. They spent 1 week in the home of one wife, both together, and then they would move for the subsequent week into the home of the other wife, together. They had 11 children between them, and they died within hours of each other when they were about 60. The reason is that one of them died, and because they had a common circulation, the poisonous, you know, the toxic breakdown product of the dying twin caused his brother to die as well. Right? But that's why they're called Siamese twins. So all of these, you get all sorts of permutations, each of them with its own issues and dilemmas and problems. But the one that I want to tell you about is a case that occurred, which occurs not infrequently, which occurred in a Jewish community, in a yeshiva community, in about 1978 or 79. And what happened was, this couple gave birth to two little girls who were joined by their chests and abdomens, right? They were known then in the press as baby girl A and baby girl B. And what turned out to be the case was that they shared livers and also a heart. The liver was not a problem. You could cut the liver in the middle, leaving enough with each twin that they could survive. But the problem was that they shared one heart, right? the children were born in a small hospital in New Jersey, and when the first doctor examined them, he heard only one heartbeat. And what turned out to be the case was that, you know, the normal human heart has four chambers. Do they study biology? The normal human heart, right, as I'm sure you're aware, it has four chambers, even in New Jersey. And therefore, there should have been eight chambers to this abnormal heart, but in fact, there were only six. And there's no way that it could be cut. And the problem was that everyone was clear, that if nothing were done, both of them would die. The reason for this is that all twins born like this had died. And the reason for that is that the heart was enough to support the circulations of the two children, but as they begin to grow, it would become inadequate. In other words, one heart pumping for two bodies, right, would go into heart failure. And in fact, on the 21st day of their lives, these little twins went into heart failure and they put into intensive care. And it was very clear that if the doctors didn't do something, they would both die. And what happened was the girls were flown to Philadelphia, to a well-known hospital there called Children's Hospital, which is known as CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I had the honor of speaking to the doctors in that hospital after this case occurred. And actually, it's very interesting because the doctors were there and the Rabbonim involved in the locally in the hospital, and also the Christian and Muslim chaplains, right, responsible for that sort of decision in the hospital. We had a very interesting discussion. If there's time, I'll tell you something about that. But what happened when the children arrived there was that the doctor who was put in charge of this case was a man known as Dr. Everett Koop. You're probably a bit young to recognize that name, but he later became the Surgeon General of the United States. And what's fascinating is that he's a very observant Protestant Christian. Right? He's the kind of man who used to spend the night in the hospital before major surgery reading the Bible to prepare himself for surgery the next day. So you have here an Orthodox Jewish family, right? Torah family. You have a Kotel family, in fact. You have a doctor who is a Protestant Christian. Children's Hospital is a Catholic institution. And the case was heard in the high court here in America because Dr. Koop was worried that if he took the life of the one child to try and save the other, somebody might charge him with homicide. Right? He didn't want a murder charge against him or the hospital if he took the life of one child to try to save the other. So fascinating. I'll try to describe to you what happened in the courtroom as well. Very amazing thing. So here's an amazing opportunity to see how do these various systems, Torah, how does Torah look at this problem? How does the non-Jewish world look at it? The various religious approaches. Amazing, amazing opportunity. So Dr. Koop said to the family, look, unfortunately, if nothing's done here, both your children are going to die. Let me try to save one. And what he proposed doing was to separate the girls, tie off the major vessels of baby girl A. The reason is that the heart was more in the chest of baby girl B. He therefore would actually kill baby girl A. He would then complete the separation of the two bodies, carry the dead body of baby girl A over to a sterile surgical table that they would have ready. He would then use her ribs to graft closure of the chest of baby girl B. Do you understand? And leave the whole part in her chest. In other words, the space where the other twin had been removed, he would close using ribs from the child that had been sacrificed and leave the whole heart in the chest of baby girl B, hoping that although it was abnormal, it would be enough for her to live.
The heart with all six valves?
Yes, with all six chambers, leave it in her chest. And that, hopefully, since it was working adequately at the time, would be enough to support the life of one child. And in fact, that probably would have been the case. So that was the proposal. Well, you can imagine the family's reaction to that. It's a very, very difficult decision, obviously. You're not only talking about saving one life when you can't save them all. Right? On Sunday morning, Mr. Shem, we're having a meeting with doctors here, and we're going to talk about the very differing problem of what's called kedima in pikuach nefesh. How do you decide who comes first when you can't save everyone? But here you're talking about killing somebody. It's much more difficult. So the family asked their rabbi, the rabbi asked his rabbi, and the question arrived eventually at the doorstep of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he had to make a decision whether surgery would be allowed or whether it would be better to do nothing and watch actually both children die. And what I'd like to share with you is the analysis of what he went through, at least according to people who were with him at the time. He never wrote a tshuva on this, so we don't have an official approach to this. And many other rabbonim subsequently have argued very strongly with some of the suggestions of the logic that he used. Although everyone who's dealt with this case has actually agreed with the outcome, there are many debates about actually what the right way is to approach it halachically. But I just want to share with you some of the issues that go into a decision like this. First of all, why are we talking about sacrificing one child? Can't you think of anything better? I can think of three better options.
Gifts of the heart.
From where? A transplant, right? Excellent, of course, beautiful. Why not simply remove baby girl A, transplant a heart into her, right? Transplant. And leave the heart in the chest of baby girl B, and that way you could save them both, right?
No more lips.
That's a good question, but that can be dealt with. There are ways of expanding the tissues so that they can actually be more than they are there. That's a good question, but that can be done. You can use artificial material. The reason that was not thought of was because this took place in 1978. The first time a baby's heart was ever transplanted, without going into all the halachic problems, transplanting a heart, taking a heart out of the donor is a big problem in halacha. But without going into all of that, the first time that was ever done was only 1986. Right? It was not even experimental back then in 1978. In fact, the first time it was done was by a Jewish surgeon in California. There was a baby born in California with heart disease. The baby was dying. The surgeon was a Jew by the name of Norman Shumway, a famous chest surgeon in California. He decided for the first time in history to transplant a heart. And of course, the major problem is finding a donor. Where do you find a baby's heart available for transplantation? And what happened then was they found a child in Vermont who was available to be a donor for this child in California. But Vermont is 3,000 miles away from California, right? Yes? But there was no other option. So they hired a private jet. They put one of the young surgeons in California into this jet. They flew him across the country to Vermont. He cut out the heart of the child in Vermont and put it into a box of special cold liquid that they used to keep the heart viable. And they couldn't get the jet to start. They ended up scrambling United States Air Force supersonic fighter. They put this terrified young doctor in the back of a supersonic fighter with a heart in a box on his lap. When they got back to California, they had to resuscitate the surgeon, okay? But they did, and they saved the life of the baby in California. But that is what you had, those are the lengths you had to go to, and back in 1970, it had never even been tried, and therefore that was not an option. Next option? Any other option of saving baby girl A?
Get more vessels from the heart.
You need a heart, not just vessels. You need a pump.
Artificial heart, right?
Artificial heart, excellent. Even today, that's not been perfected. Today, there's a lot of hope that we will soon have an implantable artificial machine that can take the place of the heart. But even today, it's not been done, and certainly not in the miniaturized version that you need for a baby. Third option?
Take tumor checkers.
No, that was not feasible.
Can you attach it to a bone like that?
No one would really consider doing. Keep a person alive the rest of their life on a machine outside. It's not really good. Any other suggestions? Well, one thought is an animal heart, right? There's a lot of work being done on animal hearts to enable them to be implanted into humans. But that is not yet feasible. In fact, an animal heart like a baboon or a pig transplanted into a human is rejected within about 6 hours. In fact, I was on a panel in London recently where they had they were busy assessing whether they could actually genetically modify pig tissues so that they would be compatible with humans. Right? Could you grow a pig heart? Yeah. And why was I on the panel? Because they wanted to know in England whether there'd be any kashrut problem, whether it'd be a kashrus problem taking a pig heart and putting it in human. I simply told them that when they genetically modify the pigs, they should simply modify them so that they're kosher, and then everything would be fine, but they didn't like my idea. Anyway, the point is that, of course, there's no problem implanting unkosher material into the body. There's not even a problem eating unkosher material to save a life, so that wouldn't be a problem. So really, I don't think there are too many other options. There's very early research now in stem cells and cloning and trying to grow human tissues, but really, there was no other option, and therefore, Dr. Koop said, look, let's take the life of baby girl A in order to save the life of baby girl B. The first question that arose was this. Stay with me carefully. The first question that Rav Moshe had to consider was, are these two little girls who are joined one person or are they two? Why is that relevant?
If there's only one person, then you're not killing anyone.
If there's only one person, you're not killing anyone. You're just cutting off part of the person. Is that allowed? In halacha, can you cut off part of the body to save the person? In fact, you have to, right? If someone has a limb or an organ that is threatening their life, you have to. By the way, do you have to cut off a limb or an organ to save someone else's life? Do you have to give up part of your body to save another person's life?
Ooh, that's I don't see why not.
That's an excellent comment. You hear what he said? If it won't kill you, no, there was risk to life. The problem is that in most practical examples, like giving a kidney, there is a risk to the life of the donor. It may be very small, but there is a risk. But if you could think of a case where there's no risk, only the giving away of the organ, I'll tell you a case. About 600 years ago, in the days of the Radbaz, Rav David Ben Zimri was a great poetic of the time, there was a Jew in Turkey who was accused of stealing by the Sultan. Now, you know what the Muslim punishment is for stealing? Cut off the head, right? So this Jew was sentenced to have his hand cut off, but he managed to escape. And he fled to Egypt, where the Radbaz was. The Sultan in Turkey captured another Jew and put him in jail. And he sent a message to the Jew in Egypt saying, if you refuse to come home, I'll kill him. If you come home, I'll release him and cut your hand off. You see the dilemma? The Radbaz, right, a fascinating chur on this. So the man went to the Radbaz to ask him, what am I obliged to do, Api Alocha? Am I obliged to go back to Turkey and have my hand cut off to save that Jew's life? Or am I allowed, the Sheikh Al-Taisir, to remain here in Egypt, even though he will die? The Radbaz has an amazing chuvah. Let's ask your Rosh Hashiva to go through this chuvah with you. It's amazing. He comes up with svaros in halacha that are remarkable. But his bottom line ruling is, his final psak is, that if a person would go back and give his hand up to save the life of the individual, it would be an incredible act of chesed, but it's not a chiyuv. In other words, he's allowed if he wants to, that would be mutter, he's allowed to, but he cannot be obliged. And that raises all sorts of issues. How do you make a decision like that? And in kidney transplantation today, which happens all the time, people are put in that very difficult situation, one second, where we say to a person, do you want to give your kidney and save your brother's life? How do you get a person to make a free will decision when the whole family is looking at them, right, and saying, how can you not do it? It's a massive problem. Imagine you have a family, there's a child dying of kidney failure. Someone else in the family matches. We say to the person, do you want to give your kidney? What if secretly they don't want to do it, but the whole family is looking at them and saying, how can you refuse? So you know how that's handled? There's a certain suggestion that was made by a certain rabbi, in fact, which is now used throughout the non-Jewish world in kidney transplantation. What they do is, they test the whole family to see whose kidney matches best with the person they want to save, and then they interview each member of the family privately and in secret. And when they speak to the person, that means no one else is present. When they speak to the person whose kidney matches, they say to them, look, your kidney matches your brother. If you agree, we'll take your kidney and save his life. If you refuse, we'll publish falsely that you did not match. No one in your family will ever know that you could have. Do you understand? We'll lie to give you the space to make your own decision. In other words, yeah, is this clear? No one will ever know in the family who matched. You'll have to make your own decision. That'll be very difficult. We will take off of you the pressure of the rest of your family. Yeah.
Wouldn't, if you went back to Turkey and got his hand cut off, wouldn't that be a chilul Hashem?
What?
And people would see his hand cut off and they would think that he is a thief.
But he's saving a life.
No, but he would make a chilul Hashem.
A chilul Hashem is never applies in a case where you do what you have to do. A chilul Hashem. Yeah.
There's a risk of death in that situation.
That though may be the case. The Radbaz doesn't handle it like that. I think the thought was they could cut his hand off and cauterize the wound in such a way that really wouldn't be a material risk to his life. The Radbaz says very clearly, by the way, that if there is any risk to his life, if there's a serious risk to his life, it's awesome. And he goes into that in detail. So, yeah. Okay. In fact, that Radbaz is one of the main sources we have today about the question of risking your life to try to save other people's lives. That's a whole subject in its own right. Let's go back to the twins. Since there was no, so the first question was, are they one person or two? What would you say about these two little girls, one person or two? I think you'd be more comfortable handling them as two, right? Okay, now listen carefully. Here's the next question. Rav Moshe Feinstein sent the following question to Dr. Poo. Stay with me carefully. He said, look, you are preparing to operate in such a way that you'll save baby girl B and sacrifice baby girl A. Could you reverse your decision? Could you save baby girl A and sacrifice baby girl B? So Dr. Koop said, ask the aged rabbi why he wants me to do the surgically impossible. Now, he didn't understand why Rav Moshe was asking him this question. And he later maintained, even to this day, he says that there's no way he could have done the surgery. That way, it was either baby girl B or nothing. There's no way that he could have reconnected all the connections to save baby girl A. Rav Moshe did not want him to save her. He was quite happy with saving baby girl B. But he needed to know very, very clearly whether there was an option of reversing it. Now let's understand why that is. Because what?
I wonder if we make a choice.
Oh, good. I know you know the answers.
I want everything.
I want the comments. Okay, so let's go through exactly what Rosh Hashiva said and what he means. He's already thought of the whole process, but let's work it out together. First of all, you have a halacha called Roidef, right? You learned Sanhedrin? Yes, no? You have a halacha called Roidef. Roidef means like this. Listen carefully. If someone is trying to kill someone else and you see that, what is your duty? Let's say all else being equal, right? A is trying to kill B. And the only way you can save B is by killing A. What do you do?
Kill.
You kill A. You're allowed to, or you're mechuyev? You're mechuyev to kill A. So, if A is trying to kill B, and there's no other way to stop him, if you can shoot him in the legs, then you have to do that, right? Not allowed to kill him if you don't have to. But if the only way you can save B is by killing A, then you've got to kill A. For homework, do you allow homework? Homework question for a whiskey. Huh?
Beer.
Beer. What are you into? Cocaine?
Don't answer that.
For homework, what if you're standing and you see A trying to kill B, and you could injure him instead of killing him, but you kill him? Are you chayev? In other words, A is trying to kill B, right? You're allowed to kill A to save B, but not if you could injure him instead of killing him. But instead of injuring him, you kill him. Are you chayev? And part B, what if the B is you? A is trying to kill you, and you turn around, and instead of injuring him, which you could do, you kill him. Are you chayev? Think about that. Well, I want you to think about it. So, yeah.
Where are you thinking of?
By the way, what's the commonest application of this halacha of Roidef? Where if A is trying to kill B, and the only way to save B is by killing A, you can kill A. Any idea? What do you think is the most common use of this halacha in the world in general? Self-defense. Who said that? Excellent. Self-defense. When the B is you, you can turn around and kill A, right? If that's the only way you can handle it, you know what I'm saying? That's right. The commonest medical application is mother and baby. Where the baby threatens, that fetus inside the mother threatens the life of the mother, the Rambam says, although Gemara doesn't put it this way, the Rambam says that's called Roidef. If the child, the pregnancy, the child is a Roidef on the mother. Rav Moshe has a fantastic chur on this. Why do we call the child a Roidef, since it has no intention to kill? And the proof of that is that when the child begins to be born, once it already comes out into the world, then if it threatens the life of the mother, it's not called a Roidef. There the Rambam says you're not allowed to take action, it's a Mishnah, right? So, it's a fascinating subject, there's lots to talk about, but if the child is inside the mother and threatening the life of the mother, the Mishnah Oiler says that you can kill the child inside the mother in order to save the mother's life. By the way, this hospital that I mentioned to you was a Catholic hospital. Do you know that the Catholics have exactly the opposite principle? The Catholics hold that if you can possibly save the child, sacrifice the mother. Do you know why? Don't ask me any questions about this, I have enough trouble keeping up with Allah. But I'll tell you what they say. They say this. According to Catholic belief, the mother has been baptized. Right? That means she's had holy water sprinkled on her, and she's saved by the grace of the founder of Christianity. The baby who's born in sin, has not been saved, will not go to the next world, and therefore it's better to save the child, to baptize the child, and let the mother die. My father, who was a doctor before me, told me that when he was working at a Catholic maternity hospital in Ireland, he told me there were times when a woman was in labor, when the husband walked over and said to him, "Doctor, if my wife's labor becomes obstructed, I want you to save the baby and sacrifice my wife." These were not cases of difficult marriages. These were cases of Catholic recon. We don't do that. In halacha, we are saving the mother, even at the cost of... This can get very complicated. I'll give you an example. In 1973 in Israel, there was a group of Israeli soldiers in Sinai, who found themselves being fired upon by another group of Israelis. You know, in war, sometimes there's a case of mistaken identity. They call it friendly fire. Right? And one group of Israelis was being fired upon by another group of Israelis. At a distance, there was a third group who saw what was happening. And in the third group, there were some frum boys who knew the halacha of Roidev. You hear this terrible situation? There's group A over here. There's group B here. Group B is shooting at group A. And they're killing him. Here's group C. They see what's going on. They cannot communicate. These boys, these guys, wanted to start shooting at group B to save halacha. If A is trying to kill B, and the only way you can... They had a terrible argument about it on the battlefield, and they did nothing. Right? They held their fire, and the guys here killed those guys there. When they got back home, they were very distressed about it. They went to see Rabbi Yoshi. And they asked him, what should we have done? He said, there's no way that you would have been allowed to fire. That's called min shamaya karatfile. In other words, these people are doing what they should be doing under genuine mistaken identity. You are not allowed to shoot at them. Question 2 for homework. What's the difference between this and the fetus inside the mother? The fetus inside the mother has no intention to kill the mother, and we kill the fetus. These soldiers have no intention to kill these people, and we're not allowed to kill them. Do you see the question? Okay? So think about that. But that is the concept of Redif. And why are we talking about Redif here, in the twins' case? Why is it relevant?
One is threatening the other one.
Maybe they're threatening each other. Maybe each of these little babies is like a Redif on the other one. Maybe B can turn around to A and say, if it weren't for you, I might live. Maybe you're a Redif on me. The Begiva Egg has a fascinating discussion. What happens when two people are trying to kill each other? Is that called Redif? When two people are trying to kill each other, can you step in and kill one? Is that called Redif? Are these two little babies trying to kill each other? Okay. And during the discussion, Rav Moshe went through, it took him 11 days, in fact, of fasting, together with members of his family. He has medically qualified people in his family. His grandson, Rav Moshe's grandson, is a physician in Lavion Hospital, in Netanya. They gave Rav Moshe the medical input, and he went through the process that was required to make a decision. The hospital took 11 days to put together all the surgical team. In fact, the non-Jews in the hospital refused to participate. Although the Christian priest said it was okay to operate, they felt emotionally unable to go into an operating room knowing that they'd see a child die. And eventually the hospital had to put together a team of volunteers, and eventually that was done. But during the discussion, some of the people asked Rav Moshe, for example, one of the young rabbonim asked him like this. They said, what if two people are coming down by parachute, and one man's parachute fails to open, so he grabs his friend's leg. But due to his weight, the parachute begins to rip. Is the man with the parachute on his back allowed to kick his friend off to a certain depth to save his own life? Is the heart like a parachute? Another one asked him, you know, the Gemara Bava Metzia says two people are walking in the desert with one bottle of water. You know this Gemara? You know this? Two people are walking in the desert. One of them has a bottle of water. If he drinks it, he'll get back to civilization. Why you'd want to do that these days beats me. But, you know, assume you won't do it. But if he shares the water with his friends, then neither one will make it. You know this Gemara? So we have the Machlokes in the Gemara, we paskin like Rabbi Akiva, right, who holds that the one who has the water drinks it. Is the heart like the bottle of water? Question number 3 for homework. What happens if two people are walking through the desert and a third party arrives with a bottle of water? Do we then go back to Ben Patera, or do we hold like Rabbi Akiva? In other words, do you understand? A and B are walking through the desert. Right? Shimon and Reuben. Reuben has a bottle of water. The halacha is Reuben has to drink the water, not share it with Shimon and both die. But what happens if it's not his water? What happens if you arrive with a bottle of water? Do you still give it to one to save one, or do you then share it between two? That's an interesting question. Okay, let's go back to the twins. The reason that Rav Moshe here wanted to know which way the surgery could be done is because of a certain halacha, which is based on incident Tanakh. I don't know if it's what you're referring to, which is like this. This is the last issue we need, and we'll come back to our twins. What happens when the Redev is one of a group? Imagine we're sitting in this room, and the building is surrounded by terrorists. Right? The Gemara deals with this. The Rambam brings it down. And they send in a message, and they say, we want one Jew to kill. Send us out one Jew, we'll kill him, the rest of you can go free. Are we allowed to send out one person to kill? That's the next point. Let's say it's not specific. They say, give us a Jew, anyone, we'll kill him, the rest of you can go free. If not, we'll kill everyone. We could make a very convincing argument. We could select a person and say, look, my friend, if you don't step outside, you're going to get killed anyway. So would you mind just... Are we allowed to do that? Yes? No? This is muskam completely. The Rambam brings, nobody argues, you're not allowed to kill a person, even if many people will die. One person can give their life in Kiddush Hashem and run. Yes. Yes. One person can run out. In fact, there are many cases of that in the Gemara and subsequent. Yeah.
Is it mutter though?
It is mutter. In fact, it's a big Kiddush Hashem.
So it's like it feasts from the four of the hand and the.
That's true. Absolutely. Yes. Not a Kiddush. Absolutely a Kiddush. In fact, the Gemara by Papa Sinud Yavis talks about that. There are many cases like this. But we are not allowed to take somebody and kill them. But here comes the Rosh Hashanah's question, which is this. Listen carefully. What happens if the non-Jews name a specific individual? They say, look, we got a problem with Finkelmodge, right? We want Finkelmodge. Send him out, we'll kill him. The rest of you can go. Are we allowed to send out Finkelmodge? Do you see that it's morally completely different? Here we're not selecting an individual, which might have been someone else. Here that person's a Gavra Kitaler, it's a dead person.
Yes. Because if he doesn't come out, I can go everywhere.
Yes, he does. He doesn't have the kind, he's not the kind of relative that intends to kill, right? But he is de facto, he is a relative here. So this, what?
Let's just send him out.
So this is a machlokes. Listen carefully. Yerushalmi, as Yerushalmi says like this, in the days of David HaMelech, there was a man called Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri had acted against David HaMelech and he had a death sentence on him. He was chayav misa. He ran away and he hid in the town of Avel. Yoav took the army and surrounded the town of Avel. And he gave them an ultimatum. He said, if you kill Sheva ben Bichri or send him out and I kill him, you can all go free. If not, I'm going to wipe you all out. So what happened, Lamaisa, was there was a very old woman there called Serach Bas Asher. She climbed up on the ramparts. She began debating the case halachically with Yoav. And in the end, she had him killed. And they threw his head over the wall. Whatever happened, they killed him. And they saved the people in the town. So listen carefully. It's Machlokes Resh Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan and Gemara Yisholmi. One of them says like this. Stay with me. You learn from this Gemara that if somebody's name, that's called Yichdu, you can have him killed. This Sheva ben Bichri was a named individual. So you see that if they asked for anyone, you couldn't do it. But if they named an individual, then you could kill him to save everyone. Agree with that? Yes? Beautiful. That's, so one shifter says like this. Since he's named, you could kill him. The other shifter says no. He was named and chayev. You need to be chayev this as well. And the other Amora says, no, he just happened to be chayav. That's not necessary. Being named is good enough. See, okay. This is an unsolved problem. The Rishonim debated, the Rambam, the Rashbo, and to this day, there's no psak on this. That means there's truth got in here. And of course, we always hold the Chumrah here, that you cannot just because you couldn't give someone to be killed. But that is at least a place where there are Rishonim who say that a person who's named, even if he's not guilty, could be killed. And therefore, if baby girl A is already Yichdu, that means she's been named or designated, there's no way we can save her. It's only a question if she's going to kill baby girl B. Do you understand what's happening? There's no way we could save baby girl A. So then it's as if to say, you could say possibly she's been designated, and therefore she's the threat of baby girl B. Okay, these are some of the issues that Rav Moshe went through. Let me tell you finally what happened, and then I'll stop if you have any questions. What happened was, due to this discussion and many others, Rav Pavarsky has a whole hasaga on this, in which he disagrees with this way of thinking, and he has his own way. There's a lot to talk about here. But in the end, Rav Moshe paskened that they were allowed to do the surgery. And in fact, they began to prepare for the surgery. An amazing incident occurred in the courtroom. You know, what happened was, Dr. Koop insisted on a court hearing, right, to authorize surgery, as I mentioned to you, so nobody would charge him with killing the baby. And in the courtroom, an amazing thing happened. And listen carefully, if this doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. Listen well. They got a bunch of lawyers to argue in front of the judges. It was a Thanksgiving day, and a three-judge panel was convened. And a team of lawyers argued in front of the judges why surgery should be allowed. And in the end, the judges accepted their reasoning. I'm not going to go into the details. And they authorized surgery. But during the court case, during the trial, the hearing, an amazing suggestion was made. And here it is. You know that back in 1978, you know one of the most difficult issues in medical halacha is what's the moment of death? Are you familiar with that problem? What is the moment of death? Today in the United States, it's defined as brain death or brainstem death, okay? In fact, throughout the whole West, with very few exceptions, when the brain is no longer functioning in a certain way, then the person is defined as dead. That's very problematic in our life, okay? Very problematic. But back in 1978 in Pennsylvania, the law was, listen well, death is defined as the cessation of spontaneous heartbeat. That means when the patient's heart stops beating, right, then the patient's dead. Are we together? So the lawyers argued as follows. Of course surgery should be allowed. What are you going to do? You're going to take the heart and leave it beating in the chest of baby girl B. If no heart stops beating, no one's done. Do you know what this means? This means if you didn't like someone, you could hack their heart out, keep it ticking in your lab, cut up the rest of it in small pieces, and no heart stop beating, no one's dying. What do you think about that? So the judges said that may be the letter of the law, but it ain't the spirit of the law, and they threw it out. But what's strange is in a democratic system where people make up the law as they go along, you get weird things like this, and I'm not going to let this happen. Now, Shimshon Rafal Hirsch said a most beautiful thing. He said, in a democracy, the people make the law. In Torah, the law makes the people. Isn't that beautiful? Anyway, in the end, the court authorized surgery, and in fact, that's what happened. It was very emotional, obviously. What happened was the doctors opened the children's chests, they separated the livers. Dr. Koop insisted on being the one to tie off the major vessels of baby girl A. Obviously, she died immediately. There was a tense moment. Would the heart continue beating? In fact, it did. He carried her body over to the table that was prepared, and they never needed her ribs because baby B's chest closed normally without needing it. And Dr. Koop gave back the body of baby girl A to the family that they could do the Levaya before sunset, before Shkia that day. And people present said it was an immense thing to see in the Kiddush Hashem, to see how the Jews and the Goyim went along with the what was required by that very difficult process in according to Aloha. Are there any questions that I'm able to answer? I'm happy to. Unfortunately, she died 47 days later. She died from a hepatitis that she got from one of the blood transfusions during something completely unrelated. Yeah, unfortunately. Yes, please.
Would the case be different if one of the babies, if you could save one of the babies for a longer period of time, but not definite? I mean,
it would be a suffix either way.
Yeah, it's going to die. But
that needs thought, but probably Rav Moshe would not have allowed them to kill one child in Osir. Okay, yeah. Redef and Chayisha. Beautiful, exactly, yeah. There's a chiluk, what we call Chayisha, Elam and Chayisha. I'll talk about that on Sunday. I don't know if they're going to be. But that's a fascinating question. What can you do for a person that's called a Chayisha? That means he could only live temporarily. Or somebody's called a Chayisha? That means somebody could live two different sets of elements. Yeah, do you have a question? Let me leave you with a question, can I? This is for a double whiskey or cocaine or whatever it is, right? Okay, listen carefully.
Just
a
double
chalice. Right?
Chalice,
double chalice. Double chalice, okay, right. Here's a question for double chalice, okay? Should have read about this. Okay. Listen well. About 1950-ish, a man was driving his car down the Carmel Mountain in Haifa. Have you been there? Very, very steep mountain, right? The brakes failed. Actually, this was an Israeli car. I'd never used the brakes before. And just used the horn. Anyway, he was coming down the mountain, the brakes failed, and he found himself careening towards a bus stop in which 10 people were standing. He couldn't stop. There was only one thing he could do. He could turn the wheel away from them, but unfortunately only to a place where 2 people were standing. Do you get it clear? He's careening down the mountain, going faster and faster. There's 10 people in front of him. He can't stop. He can turn, but only to a place where there are 2 people standing. What should he have done? So they went to ask the Chazon Ish after this what he should have done. The Chazon Ish said he should have turned the wheel and killed the 2 people. Is that problematic? Does that contradict anything we learned this morning? So they said to the Chazon Ish, but doesn't that contradict the Rambam that we learned this morning? If 10 people are in a room and you're given an ultimatum, you can kill 2 people to save the 10. Are you allowed to kill the 2? Definitely not. Let's say they're both yichud. Let's take an example. Let's get it clear. I want 2 identical situations. Let's get it clear. There's 10 people in front of me, right? The car's going towards them. If B'shei Baal Tasi, I do nothing, 10 people are going to die. I turn the wheel and kill 2 people. Should I do that? Said the Chazon Ish, yes. There's 10 people in a room, going surrounding the room. If I do nothing, they kill all 10 people. If I pick up a gun and shoot 2 people, the same 2, identify. And I save the 10 in the room, am I allowed to do that?
No.
No? Why not? These are exactly parallel situations. You get it? Well, think about that. It's an amazing question. Don't tell me, well, maybe Yichdu are 2 parallel situations. 10 people in front of you, okay, do nothing, they die. Turn the wheel, you kill 2, yes. 10 people in a room, threatened with death if I do nothing? They give me a gun and they say, kill two people? Am I allowed to do that? Definitely not. And the Chazal showed them the reason, the difference here, pure svara. Don't read out the Gemara's other background. Let me leave that with you. This is a fascinating question. And I hope this gives you at least a few sleepless nights.
Have a good show.